Good evening, everyone. Tonight we'll start in Isaiah 61, if you want to take your Bibles to that chapter, Isaiah 61. If you were unable to be with us yesterday, I introduced my part of this series with the title, When God Glorifies His Children, which sounds kind of upside down. Most of the time when we talk about glorification, we talk about how we are the ones who glorify God, which is the ultimate goal. We want to be people who bring glory to the God that made us and saved us and that we love. But one of the things the Bible teaches is that the way God brings glory to himself is to first glorify us, which we started to explore a little bit in the prophecies of Isaiah, and then we looked at in the life of Jesus. You remember Jesus would say all the time, Father, glorify me so that I can glorify you. Glorify your son so that I can bring glory to you. That concept finds its way all through the New Testament. And I'll say a little bit more about that. But draw your attention here to Isaiah 61. I mentioned this yesterday, but the first couple of verses of this chapter that Jesus read in his hometown synagogue describe us not yet glorified. Listen to it again. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives and freedom to prisoners, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord, the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant those who mourn in Zion, giving them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a spirit of fainting. So they will be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. Notice the last part of that verse 3. The ultimate goal is God's going to glorify himself, but he's going to do it by taking people who are broken, in despair, fainting, mourning, not glorified people at all, people in darkness, and lifting them out of that and putting them on display to bring glory for himself. Now, the reason I'm taking you to this passage is when we get to verse 9, look at verse 9, God makes this prediction. Then their offspring will be known among the nations, their descendants in the midst of the peoples. All who see them will recognize them because they are the offspring whom the Lord has blessed. That God's going to take people from verses 1 through 3 and actually make them recognizable in the world. That people will see them and know there's something different about this person because, go back up to verse 7, at the end of verse 7, everlasting joy will be theirs. These are people who have peace that passes understanding and joy in their lives that can't be explained. God lifts them up or glorifies them to bring attention to himself. Now, a couple of other things before we go to the New Testament. Go back to verse 4. Verse 4 begins a section of this chapter where it tells us what God wants to do with us. Verses 1 through 3 describe what Jesus came to do for us. But verses 4 through the end of the chapter describe what Jesus came to do with us. Listen to what he wants to do with us. Then they will rebuild the ancient ruins. They will raise up the former devastations. They will repair the ruined cities, the desolation of many generations. Strangers will stand and pasture your flocks. Foreigners will be your farmers and your vine dressers. But you will be called the priests of the Lord. You will be spoken of as ministers of our God. You will eat the wealth of nations, and their riches you will boast. Instead of your shame, you'll have a double portion. Instead of humiliation, they will shout for joy over their portion. Therefore, they will possess a double portion in their land. Everlasting joy will be theirs. Notice that he takes these broken people from verses 1 through 3, and he turns them loose in the world to rebuild the place, making them priests and ministers, and when we get to verse 9, recognizable to people. All right, keep those concepts in your mind. And let's go to the New Testament, to the book of 1 Peter. We'll spend the rest of our time in this great letter. I mentioned that another way to look at this topic is that the New Testament letters that were written, whether by Paul or by Peter or by James or whoever. They are evangelism handbooks. When they were written to any given church in some location, the ultimate goal for the people of God in that place was to bring glory to the God that saved them. And to spread the gospel, to spread the word, to show the world that there was good news. But what's interesting about the New Testament letters is they don't sound like an evangelism seminar that you might go to nowadays. Sometimes churches ask me to come talk about evangelism. And what they want me to do is to get up and say, all right, church, get your words figured out. Go knock on all the doors. Go say all the right things. And if you've got the right formula, they're going to respond. But you never read something like that in the New Testament. You just don't read it. What you'll read is like what we talked about last night in the book of Philippians. Doesn't matter whether you're in jail or life looks dark. If you can be content in every circumstance that you're in, the gospel will be furthered. If you can rejoice in the Lord always, again, I'll say rejoice, people will see that and recognize that. Philippian jailers will ask to be saved when they hear you singing from the prison cell. That there is a way that God elevates us, glorifies us, makes us the light of the world so that he can bring glory to himself. 1 Peter is no different. In fact, I'll suggest 1 Peter might be one of the greatest evangelism handbooks in the New Testament. Let me set the scene for you. Verse 1 of chapter 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, who are chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, by the sanctifying work of the Spirit, to obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with his blood, may grace and peace be yours in the fullest measure. When Peter begins this letter, he writes to those who are aliens, scattered, diaspora, the seeds that's been spread all over the place. And you're going to find out as you read the letter that these people who are aliens, they don't feel at home where they live. They feel displaced. I'm going to give you four words that describe the tone or the atmosphere that these people lived in. Number one, the word is they were disoriented. These people weren't at home anymore. They'd been scattered from where they used to be. Remember in the book of Acts, they lived in Jerusalem. The community of the Christians there was something special. Saul wreaked havoc in the church, and that church was just scattered. And wherever those Christians went to live, it wasn't home anymore. They were disoriented. You ever had a time like that in your life? Where maybe circumstances made you move. You went away to college or your job transferred you or something changed. And you moved from the south to the north. And you were like, I'm living on Mars. I don't even know where I'm at. The people don't sound like me. The culture's not like me. I'm just not at home anymore. You ever had a time like that? And it may not even be geographic. It could be just how life has changed. In fact, Eric was talking about this a bit ago. Let me run a little scenario by you, or just ask this question. How many of you over 60 years old feel like the world you're living in right now, the country you're living in right now, is not the one you remember when you were young? You're sort of disoriented by what the thing looks like now. Is that true for some of you? Does that feel right? You don't feel like it's home anymore. All right, that's over 60. How many of you over 40 feel like that? I mean, I'm 50 now, and I'll tell you, when I go back to where I grew up, it's not the place I grew up. And the things that are being done and talked about don't feel like home anymore. Young people, you need to hear what I'm about to say. Some years from now, you're going to talk the same way we do. You're going to say, the world that I grew up in is so different now, and it's going to feel disorienting. All right, that's the first of the words. Second thing that these people would have been feeling was distress. Not just being disoriented, but go a little bit further. Read down around verse 6. Chapter 1, verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. You ever had a time in your life where some trial or some set of trials was just distressing you? And if you think this is just like light distress, keep reading the next few verses. He describes it as fire, like being in fire and going through the fire. So these people were disoriented. They were going through trials like fire. They lived lives of difficulty. There were a lot of difficult things for them. Go to chapter 2 and look at verse 13. Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Now notice how this paragraph starts with submit yourself to these governing authorities and officials, emperors, kings, and rulers. You know, one of the things I hear Christians say a lot lately is that's one of the most difficult things about living in our time. Are the leaders? Are the people in charge? And even if for a little while you like one of them, just wait a few years and you're not going to like the next one. But do you know who Peter was talking about when he was writing to the Christians? Do you know who the emperor was at the time? Nero. If you think it's difficult to live in the United States of America right now, we really don't know anything about difficulty. We don't. It wouldn't be too long from this point that Nero would begin to take Christians alive, dip them in oil while they were still alive, hang them on stakes while they were still alive, light them on fire to light up his garden parties where him and his friends would gather to kill more Christians for fun. And it was men like that that Peter would say, submit yourself for the Lord's sake. And you might want to argue with Peter and say, but they don't deserve any kind of honor. They don't deserve any kind of submission. Peter knows that. Look back at verse 15. He knows that they're foolish men. He knows it. He's not saying that these are good men. These are people that we need to silence. And part of the way we silence them is submitting. Now, this is in a larger section. This difficulty section goes from chapter 2, verse 13 through like chapter 3, about halfway through the chapter. But he keeps saying submit, submit, submit. Look at verse 18. Here's another group that he talks to. Servants or slaves, be submissive to your masters with all respect. Now, I want you to imagine sitting in a first century Christian assembly. And the letter of 1 Peter shows up, and it's going to be read publicly. And you're a slave. Your master let you go to go to the assembly that day to worship your God. And here's Peter saying, slaves, maybe your head picks up and you say, wait, he's talking to me. Submit to your masters with all respect. And maybe you think to yourself, I think I can do that. My master's not such a bad guy. You know, you let me come to the assembly tonight. But across the room, there's another slave who thinks, yeah, you've got one of those good masters. I don't have one. Surely Peter can't be talking to me. Read the next phrase. Not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. For this finds favor with God. For the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows while suffering unjustly. Folks, this is a really hard thing to say to somebody who's in a difficult situation with a slave owner, a master who's not treating them very well. And that life of difficulty and trial and disorientation, you're being told, be respectful, behave yourself. Chapter 3, verse 1, the conversation continues with women married to men. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Now these women were being asked to submit to men who weren't always behaving themselves. They didn't obey the word. They weren't always acting the way they should. And to round it out, look at verse 7. Chapter 3, verse 7. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. I think the implication here is, sometimes men are married to women that are really hard to understand. It's not always easy to be married. But notice that the people Peter's writing to were going through very difficult situations, whether it was the government, whether it was their workplace, or the way that they lived, or their marital situation, their family life. And let me give you one more word. So they were disoriented, they were distressed, they were going through difficulty, and the world that they lived in was very dark. Look back at chapter 2 and listen to verse 11. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. You know, if you really think about verses 11 and 12, there's nothing easy in verses 11 and 12. Number one, in verse 11, there's a war going on inside of you. Like, there's darkness inside of you that you're trying to fight anyway, warring against your soul. Then in verse 12, you've got darkness outside of you, slandering you for trying to do what's right as you wage war in your own soul. But this is sometimes the way life is. We're dealing with our own darkness. We're dealing with the darkness outside of us. Go to chapter 4. Listen to it here. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore, since Christ also suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, abominable idolatries. In all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation, and they malign you. But they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. I want you to just catch the language here. When Peter says, arm yourselves with this purpose of suffering, he's not talking about external persecution here. He's actually talking about internal suffering of getting sin out of your life. You arm yourself with it. It doesn't come at you. You do it. And it's one of the hardest things to do. You ever seen somebody come out of a culture that is described here? They grew up all their life drinking, parties, sexual immorality. Whatever their stomach told them to do, they did it. Whatever their appetite told them to do, they did it. They just lived their life for their own pleasure. And then they came to the Lord and they knew they had to get out of it. They knew they had to suffer through getting sin out of their life. Is there anything easy about that? You know what happens to people like that? As they suffer to get sin out of their life, eventually they get to verse 5 or verse 4. And every one of their friends, every one of the people that they once did these things with, begin to add insult to the injury of what they're already losing. And they start telling them they're crazy. Did you join a cult? What happened to you? Why are you the way you are? You've lost your mind. Folks, we need to be a little more compassionate, I think, with people who are coming out of the world, trying to get sin out of their life, while everyone around them that they've ever known is telling them that they're fools for doing it. But now that's the scene. There might be more to say about this, but just imagine you were living in a time where you felt disoriented, distressed. You were going through all these difficult situations. There was darkness inside of you and outside of you. Let me tell you what I want Peter to say. You know what I want Peter to say? Just try to make it through. Just try to survive this. I mean, if you got to crawl across the finish line, I just hope you make it. But that's not how Peter writes. Peter actually writes in the letter, God's got some expectations for y'all. God actually wants to do some things with you. And God believes that these people in this state can change the world. How? And here's the Bible's way of saying it. He's going to glorify them in their situation so that he can get glory for himself. How? Let me give you two words. In the book of 1 Peter, two words about how God glorifies us in this situation are excellence and hope. If God can teach these Christians to live with excellence, God's going to get some things done. And if God can teach these Christians to live with hope, even though everything about their circumstances look hopeless, he promises them that people are going to begin to recognize them, notice them. Let me show you what I mean. Go back to chapter 2, and let's start reading in verse 9. Chapter 2, verse 9. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into marvelous light. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. You know what's almost strange to me is that Peter, through the whole letter, keeps acknowledging, I know y'all are disoriented. I know you're distressed by various trials like fire. I know that you're going through difficult times. I know the world's really dark. But then he says, like, but you're a holy nation, a royal priesthood. You're a people for God's own possession. And did you see the two ways that he talks about excellence? Now, the New American Standard helps with this. Verse 9 says that as the priests of God, which that's the language from Isaiah 61 where we started, as the priests of God, we proclaim the excellencies of God. Your version might say the praises of God. And folks, that's just the truth of the matter. I cannot stand around in my life and proclaim my excellencies. Do you know why? Because I'm not. I'm not excellent. God did not come down to help me because I was excellent. He came down to help me because I was a mess. And the only way that I can ever get the message across about who God is by me with my mouth speaking of his excellencies. But you know what a lot of people think, a lot of Christians think? That's all I got to do, As long as I talk about the excellencies of God, I can still kind of be in my darkness. I can still kind of be in my despair. I can still kind of still be one of those mournful people or brokenhearted people or people who are fainting. As long as I talk about the excellencies of God, I don't really have to change anything. Until you get to verse 12. And he tells the priests that are speaking of the excellencies of God to keep their behavior, what? Excellent. You aim to be like the God who you're talking about. And when they say things about you, you prove them wrong. Because you're going to act in ways that they're going to look at you and think you're nuts. But someday, when the visitation of God happens, whether that's in their own life at some point, or whether that's ultimately when God comes back, they will see that God is worthy to be glorified because you've been excellent in your life. But for a lot of us, myself included, I just throw excellency out the window when life gets too hard for me. Excellence and hope. You know, there's a really important thing that happens right in the middle of this book. It's actually in the middle of that submission section. Submit to the government, submit to your masters, wives submit to your husbands, husbands live with your wives in an understanding way. There's a paragraph in the middle. Look at chapter 2, verse 21. It's a parenthetical. It's like Peter knows that he's saying crazy things. And so in this parenthetical, in this little paragraph, he stops and he says, now look, folks, here's the whole plan that God has about how to change a world that's so dark. Here's the plan. You ready? Listen to it. For you've been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. While being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. For you were continually straying like sheep, but now you've returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. I believe this to be one of the most powerful things that Peter said to the first century Christians. And it parallels pretty much everything Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount to the Christians, or to the people he was beginning to teach about the kingdom. It sounds a little bit like this. When Jesus was going through his disorienting, distressing, difficult, dark moment, he kept his behavior excellent. He didn't speak back to the people the way that they were speaking to him. He didn't insult them or threaten them when they were doing that to him. And the way that he did it was he entrusted himself to his Father, who judges righteously. What's always been strange to me about that is, I love Jesus. I believe he was God in the flesh. Couldn't he have judged righteously in the moment? Like, wouldn't he have had every right to call the 12 legions of angels? Wouldn't he have? You should be glad it wasn't me. I would have nuked the place. I would have. But he didn't do it. He kept his behavior excellent. The words in his mouth weren't insults or threats. And then something really interesting happened. He healed the people that were hurting him. He healed the people that were hurting him. You know, this last thing that it says in verse 25, we were continually straying like sheep, but now you've returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. That's backwards. Normally, if a sheep's gone astray, what does the shepherd do normally? Goes after him. Not in this verse. In this verse, the shepherd didn't go after them. He was lifted up on a cross. And you know what it says about the sheep? Who were the ones that actually put him on the cross? Who were the ones that actually betrayed him? Who were the ones that actually made him go to that place? Who were the ones that actually wounded him and scourged him? They saw the silent, excellent suffering of their shepherd. And it so moved them that they came back. Why does he say that in the middle of all of this submission stuff? I think it's because most of us think the only way I'm going to change the government, the only way I'm going to change my evil boss, the only way I'm going to change my wife or my husband or the people around me that are harming me, the only way I'm ever going to fix them is I'm going to make them hurt to the point where they'll repent. But that's not the model of Jesus Christ. The sufferer is me. If by his wounds I am healed, maybe part of following Jesus is by our wounds, they'll eventually be healed. Now let me tell you why I think that's what's going on here. Go to chapter 3, listen to verse 8. To sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for this very purpose, that you might inherit a blessing. For the one who desires life to love and see good days must keep his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation. Do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. I never expected to be an evangelist. I didn't think I would ever be a preacher. But let me tell you how God made me one. When I was a kid, my mom passed away. I was 10 years old. She was 42. In that world that I lived in, I remember being disoriented. I remember that. I remember not really knowing even where home was, you know. I remember being distressed in my grief and in the confusion of all of that. And I remember that my whole world became my friends in my neighborhood. They were decent kids at the time. They were worldly, but they weren't too bad. But when 10-year-old Andy became 12, when we were in 7th grade, every one of those friends, every one of them, started doing drugs. They all started smoking marijuana. Then they started dropping acid. Then they started chewing shrooms. And one day, one of my friends took rock cocaine out of his pocket. We were 12. And I knew at that point that I couldn't be there anymore. I had to suffer, like chapter 4 says, the loss of these people in my life. So I walked away. I remember I sat down under a tree the day that my friend took rock cocaine out of his pocket. And I remember it was the first time I'd cried in a while. And I said, God, my mom's gone. I don't really know how to talk to Dad. I've lost all my friends. I said, you've got to be my friend. I remember saying that. So for the next couple of years, I just walked with him, wrestled with some things. Strange thing happened. Somewhere in those years, I started smiling again. I kind of had like a skip about me. I got to high school, and I knew who I was. And I was joyful. And a weird thing happened. Some of those kids who'd been struggling with the things they were struggling with, look again at chapter 3, verse 15. They began to come back to my life and literally would say this. I remember the first time it happened. One of the kids came back and said, "Hey, why are you happy? You should be miserable." And it was in that moment that God made me an evangelist. Because the only thing I knew how to say was, I have God in my life. Amen. I have hope. I love who He is and what He's doing. We've got something upside down with evangelism. We do. We got a bunch of people who aren't letting God give them hope, aren't letting God make them radiant, aren't letting God make them joyful, aren't finding contentment in all their circumstances, aren't living excellent lives. But we think we're going to go out there and convince people that we've got good news. God makes a promise here. If you just hope in me, if you don't get so freaked out by your circumstances that you start fighting everything around you, if you live with this radiance in your life, people are going to come and ask you the reason for the hope that's in you. And you got to be ready to tell them. You know, up in Minnesota, there's a lot of evangelism going on. That little church up there is not so little anymore. We're about 250, 260. But if you come and look at our church, I'll tell you what you won't find. Is you won't find a whole bunch of brilliant evangelistic minds. You won't. If you were to say to any one of them, how would you teach somebody the gospel? Most of them would say, I'm not really sure. But do you know what's happening there? Is you've got people who are pretty new Christians who love what God's done for them. And they are in front of the people that they're living with hope and excellence and joy, and they're just trying to be Christians. And for whatever reason, they keep bringing people around. They keep bringing people. The nations have come running because God has glorified them. What if every Christian learned this? That we prayed things like, Dear Father in heaven, please, glorify me so that I can glorify you. Give me the hope that you describe. Give me the excellence in my life. Help me to find ways to speak of your excellence. Let me be content and joyful in my circumstance. And help people, Father, to see it and come and wonder at it. What you've done, not what I've done, what you've done. What could God do with people like that? I hope you're starting to get the concept of this. Tomorrow night, we'll talk about Titus, the book of Titus. In that book, there's more ways that God would glorify the Christians in that place. Let me tell you one more story. When I was preaching in Los Angeles, I may have told this here before, but it's always good to hear it. There was a young woman who came to worship with us in L.A. Her name was Dana Mars. She's now Dana Wade. She had just graduated college, but she went to work for JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratories. She was a rocket scientist, brilliant girl. But she'd come and worship in our little congregation, and she was always faithful. That's when 9/11 happened. The planes flew into the buildings, the world caught on fire. About 2 weeks later, Dana showed up, and there was a young man sitting next to her. And I went up and I said, "Hey, my name's Andy. Who are you?" He said, "My name's Jamin Greenbaum." I said, "What brought you here today?" He said, "I've never been in a church before. Not ever." He said, "I work with Dana over at JPL. He said, "I've always been too smart for God." And I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" He said, "The other day when the planes flew into those buildings, I looked around the room at all the people that I admired most, all the smartest people that I'd ever known. And he said, they were all losing their minds. They were all so afraid. And he said, and then I looked at Dana. And she was appropriately sad about the whole thing, but it did not take away her joy. She didn't seem afraid. And this is what he said to me. He said, I want what she has." Dana Mars did not need to know how to answer every scientist's question. That's not what apologetics means. 1 Peter 3:15 does not mean you need to know every answer to give a reason for every question that somebody asks you. The verse says you need to know what to tell them when they ask you about your hope. She hoped in front of them. She lived excellently in front of them. She had a radiance about her that was not about any argument that she gave. And Jamin became a Christian. What are you going to do tomorrow where you live, where you work? Let God lift you above the darkness of that place. Thanks for your attention. If you're not a Christian, I hope you'll realize that Jesus is suffering on the cross for you. If you're a sheep that's gone astray, look over your shoulder. Look what you've done to him. Return to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. You put him there. And his willingness to silently suffer for you should draw you back to him. Come back to him while we stand and sing.